it's Diane. On my mind, could Ukraine win the war with Russia?
Had you interviewed me 2 weeks ago, I would have said, oh, it's a war of attrition, it's a stalemate, and then suddenly it's much more dynamic now and the Ukrainians are on the offensive.
Last week, Ukrainian forces made dramatic gains on the battlefield, retaking the land in the east and south, including Ukraine's second largest city. And now some experts say this could be the beginning of a victory for Kyiv. My guest today is Angela Stent, author of the book Putin's World, Russia Against the West and with the Rest. She joined me Thursday morning to help us understand whether this is truly a turning point, what a Ukrainian victory might look like, and what it could mean for the future of Russia and its role in the world. Angela, please tell me about the latest advances made by Ukrainian forces.
So in the last 10 days, it's been really quite remarkable what the Ukrainians have managed to do. They have managed in the northeast of Ukraine to take back the Kharkiv region. Kharkiv is the second largest city in Ukraine after Kyiv. And they obviously were planning this well beforehand. They have liberated a number of towns and villages, people who for the past 6 months had a total blackout of news, were under Russian occupation. And of course, unfortunately, they found in these places elements of the kind of atrocities that we saw in the surrounding areas to Kyiv after the Russians left Kyiv much earlier on in the war.
They found thousands of bodies.
They did. They found thousands of bodies. They're still digging bodies up. So this unfortunately seems to be a pattern. And the other thing that's remarkable, or maybe it's not remarkable about this, is that the Russian troops just fled. They dropped everything. They left all their equipment. They were in the middle of eating a meal. They left the meal and they just ran away. And some intercepted conversations that we have heard now between Russian soldiers and their loved ones in Russia, just describing with unprintable language just how badly, you know, their commanders behaved in this, or nobody gave them instructions. And so it was just like a rout, and they essentially ran away back into Russia. And Russia is very near, the border with Russia is very near Kharkiv.
So the war seemed to be at kind of a standstill. How did this happen? You say it had been planned for months, but who knew?
Well, I think, you know, the Ukrainians, they were very clever because there was also a certain amount of deception. They kept signaling that they were going to take back Kherson, which is a city in the south of Ukraine, again, taken very early on by the Russians. And so the Russians started deploying their troops towards Kherson because they wanted to hold on to it. And meanwhile, there was all of this planning. And I'm not sure that anyone, even we totally in the United States government, knew this was going to happen. We have to say that it's obviously the U.S. weapons and weapons from other NATO countries, but maybe the American ones, that have enabled the Ukrainians to do this. Because, yeah, had you interviewed me 2 weeks ago, I would have said, oh, it's a war of attrition. It's a stalemate. The Russians haven't taken any territory since June, but then Ukrainians haven't taken that much either. And then suddenly, it's much more dynamic now, and the Ukrainians are on the offensive. So we can only say that this was really quite well planned and very cleverly hidden from view.
So why now?
Because I think, you know, precisely because there was this stalemate, there was attrition, winter is coming, and the Ukrainians realize that they have a rather short window in order to launch this kind of a counteroffensive. And they definitely, you know, would be much harder to do in November, December, January. So I think the timing does have to do with the seasons as well, and the fact that they have been getting all of this equipment from the United States and they're using it well.
And as we are speaking on Thursday, I gather there is a meeting between Putin and Xi Jinping. And I wonder what Putin is trying to get out of this meeting.
Well, I found it very interesting. This is a regional summit, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization in Uzbekistan. And I watched Putin's initial remarks today, and he actually said, we know that the Chinese have some concerns about Ukraine, which I think you could say is an understatement. I mean, what Putin wants is he wants continued support from China. So the last time he met Xi Jinping in person was on February the 4th, just before the Olympic Games began in Beijing and before the war began. And what Russia has gotten from China is verbal support. The Chinese have repeated all the Russian propaganda about this was NATO threatening Russia and it had to do something to defend itself. They have gotten no material support from the Chinese. The United States has made it perfectly clear to the Chinese that if they were to supply weapons to Russia, then there would be sanctions, at least from on the US point of view, on China. Nor have the Chinese violated any of the Western sanctions, as far as we can see, because their economic interests in relations with the US and with Europe and with our Asian allies are much bigger than their economic interests with Russia. So what Putin would like is, I think, continued verbal support from China. I'm sure he would like more material support. And when he has his one-on-one with Xi Jinping, he may well ask for that. But I don't think the Chinese are going to do that.
Why not?
Because, again, I mean, China has interests that go beyond Russia. And the relationship with the U.S. and Europe is difficult. But still, these are very important economic relationships. Xi Jinping is coming up to a very important party congress where he hopes to extend his rule for, I don't know how many, maybe an indefinite number of years. And so he wants to appear in charge. He's not going to ditch Russia, but he's going to be careful about what he does.
You recently co-wrote a piece for Foreign Affairs with Fiona Hill, and you're releasing another chapter to your book, Putin's World, next week. And in both, you describe the underpinnings of Putin's obsession with controlling Ukraine. Help us understand that.
Sure. So I think Putin has very clearly all along believed, as he said in 2005, that the collapse of the Soviet Union was the 20th century's greatest geopolitical catastrophe. Why? Because there were Russians living in places outside of Russia and that Russia lost what rightfully belongs to it. And so in a speech just a few months ago, he said, he praised Peter the Great, one of his heroes, the 17th century Tsar who went to war with Sweden and absorbed the Baltic states. And he said, you know, these are territories that belong to us and that rightfully we should take back. And Ukraine has been his, special obsession. Ukraine, after all, was a very important part of the Soviet Union. And its independence deprived Russia certainly of some of its economic strength. But more importantly, I think Putin really believes, or he's convinced himself, that Ukrainians aren't a separate nation, that this is something, it's all the fault of the West now. And before, as he said in an essay he wrote last year on the unity of Ukrainians and Russians, he blamed the Bolsheviks, he blamed Lenin for creating a separate Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, which gave the Ukrainians the idea that they could maybe have their own state. So he thinks this is artificial. And Putin is someone who believes in general in the concept of defensive expansionism. And this is something you can go back to another czar who's one of his heroes, heroines, Catherine the Great, who said that which stops growing begins to rot. I have to expand my borders in order to keep my population safe. So this idea that Russia doesn't have natural borders in the east or west, and that historically Russia has expanded, taken neighboring territories, sometimes it lost them, and then taking them back again. And that's, again, a very core part of Putin's understanding of Russia's role on the Eurasian landmass.
So at this point, with Russian troops in retreat, with Ukraine taking back that which was theirs, what is Putin's next move likely to be?
So obviously, nobody thinks that at this point Putin's going to declare, okay, the war's over, we made a mistake. He's not going to do that. He could declare victory and say, well, we took a little more territory, and the Russians have taken some more territory in Ukraine, and that's what I was going to do all along, and we'll go home. But I don't think anybody thinks that's going to happen anytime soon. You now have a debate in Russia, even on the public airwaves of state-run TV, between people who are saying you've got to go much further, you've got to do general mobilization. Call this a war, don't call it a special military operation.
And that would require a draft, wouldn't it?
Exactly. So that would require a universal draft. And so far, Putin hasn't wanted to do it because I think the Kremlin's very concerned about much more opposition to the war. So far, they've been drafting these young men from the most poor, benighted areas of the Russian Federation. They have very bad job prospects. They sign a contract and they earn money. And if they're killed, their parents get financial compensation. And a lot of those young men are not ethnically Russian either. And the idea of doing a mass mobilization and drafting urban, educated young men, Russians, many of them, who would then be told to fight and kill people who look like them and sound like them, that would raise much more opposition. That's partly what happened with the Soviet war in Afghanistan when they started drafting all these people and the opposition grew much bigger. So Putin hasn't been willing to do that yet, and I don't see that he will. I mean, what they're doing now is they're recruiting people from prisons. You can see a video now of the head of the Wagner group, these mercenaries, going to prisons and saying, spend 6 months in Ukraine and then you'll go free. You won't go back to jail. And by the way, if you don't like it and you don't want to do it, then you'll be killed. So that there's that. Then there are people in Russia who, again, interestingly, on the public airways, are talking about, well, maybe we should negotiate with the Ukrainians. But that's very much a minority. One of the things we can expect is an asymmetric response to this. We already have a huge problem in the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, the largest nuclear power plant in Europe, which the Russians have occupied and turned into a military base. It's very dangerous. They've shut down the nuclear reactors there, but you could still have an accident there. And the Russians have also been attacking other aspects of Ukraine's power supply. Just yesterday, after all of the rout of the Russian army, they attacked a hydropower station. And so they can really make life very difficult. They've already deprived Ukraine of 20% of its electricity by closing down this power plant. Some people worry that Putin could use a form of WMD, a tactical nuclear weapon, a chemical weapons. Nobody knows. That would definitely be escalatory, and you could ask, what would he accomplish by that? So there are other things that Russia can do short of sending back more troops and mounting a counteroffensive, which apparently at the moment they don't appear to be in a position to do.
And what is the United States prepared to do?
So we have, of course, provided the Ukrainians with the bulk of the weapons they've been getting, billions and billions of dollars of them. I think we're up to maybe $13 billion now. And the Biden administration has said there will be more to come. And of course, the Ukrainians keep asking for more weapons, because without the U.S. weapons and training, and they're being trained in Europe too, they wouldn't be able to do this. What would we do if Russia were to use, you know, to escalate this? The administration just said there'll be consequences. You know, nobody knows what they would be because they can't, you know, publicly you don't announce that. But I think the U.S. is prepared to, this administration, to be in this for the long run, understanding that this is a struggle not only just for Ukraine, but essentially for the rest of Europe and for what the future of what Russia will try and do in the world.
So how does NATO figure into all of this?
Well, so the NATO has been involved in training Ukrainian troops. Different NATO countries have. NATO is obviously supporting very much the U.S. efforts. And individual NATO countries are supplying weapons, some more than others. The further west you get, you know, there's more hesitation there. Germany, even though it's has sent a lot of money to Ukraine and has really changed its position toward Russia, the Germans are still wary of supplying weapons, tanks, to Ukraine, you know, given their history and you know, 30 years since the Soviet collapse, of saying we won't send weapons to war zones. But so that's how NATO gives logistical support and you know, has signed an agreement with the Ukrainians saying we're going to continue supporting you and training you.
Now a quick break. Hi, it's Diane. Join me for my next book club event, a conversation with Sheila Johnson. She's co-founder of BET, all about her memoir, Walk Through Fire. That's coming up Wednesday, April 24th at 6 p.m. Eastern. Find out more. Register at dianeweem.org/bookclub. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with Angela Stent. Her most recent book is Putin's World. Angela, there was a moment in Syria when President Barack Obama drew a red line. Suppose Russia does use chemical or nuclear weapons on Ukraine. What do you see the U.S. doing at that point?
Well, I think there would certainly be more sanctions. There would be an attempt to oust Russia from the remaining organizations in which it's still international organizations, although, you know, you would be very difficult to oust them from the United Nations, for instance, but at least some kind of greater international isolation. The U.S., you know, is presumably not going to directly use weapons on Russia, clearly, because then that would, you know, we're the two nuclear superpowers, that's unthinkable. So there's a limit to what the U.S. could do, but it would try, I guess, just much even greater isolation. But that's difficult because, you know, while the West is certainly has sanctioned Russia and condemned it, most of the rest of the world hasn't. And I don't know how they would respond, you know, China, India, South Africa, all of these countries, how they would respond to a Russian use of, say, a tactical nuclear weapon.
So, Angela, is there any likelihood in your mind that we could come to some sort of negotiated settlement?
It's, of course, possible. Right now, it's not in Ukraine's interest to sit down with the Russians because the Ukrainians, you know, at least want the Russians to withdraw to where they were before February the 24th. Yes. And ideally, as President Zelensky has said, to get out of Ukraine altogether, although the Crimea question, I think, has to be postponed. And even the Ukrainian government recognizes that. The Russians have said that they will only sit down to negotiate if Ukraine accepts their conditions. And the conditions have to do with demilitarization and really a change of government at a minimum. It would still mean subordination to Russia. So right now, I think it's out of the question. And I do think the more of these atrocities that are discovered in the wake of Russia's retreat from some of these places, the more difficult it becomes to negotiate. 90% of the Ukrainian population want the government to continue fighting until they recoup. They have territorial integrity again. And so Zelensky himself, I think, wouldn't be able to outlive a negotiation where, he might physically outlive it, but politically he could no longer, I think, be in office if he did that. So right now, it appears to be very unlikely that there'll be negotiations.
So even though you have all these deaths occurring in Ukraine, the Ukrainian people continue to support President Zelensky, believe he should not go to the negotiating table, but continue to fight on.
Yes, and we don't know how large the casualties are from Ukraine, but they're obviously quite significant, as they are, of course, on the Russian side. Yeah, despite all of the deaths, the majority of you, vast majority of Ukrainians want this war to continue, you know, until the Russian occupiers get out.
But do we know what the ordinary Russian people feel? Those who are parents of those young men who were drafted, who were pulled into service.
So that's much more difficult to gauge. We have to remember, since the war, 400,000 Russians have left Russia because they oppose the war. They are living either in the Baltic states, Armenia, Georgia, or in Europe, or some in the United States.
400,000.
400,000. That is the figure that people give. So those are significant numbers of people have left because they opposed the war or because they didn't want to fight in it. So of those remaining, again, it's very hard to gauge public opinion, but the one kind of independent polling organization, their data suggests that by now, almost half of the Russian population have kind of shut this out of their minds. I mean, this is what Putin wants. This is why he doesn't have a general draft. And so I've talked to people, you know, who live in Moscow, and they say, you really wouldn't know there's a war going on. The restaurants are open. Life goes on as normal. You can't buy those Western goods that you liked in the supermarket. But, you know, there's food on the shelves and there are things to buy. And so for those people, they've kind of shut it out of their minds. Just a couple of weeks ago, as the Ukrainians were retaking Kharkiv, you had this big celebration in Russia celebrating 875 years of the city of Moscow, and people were dancing in the streets. Putin unveiled a Ferris wheel that then, of course, malfunctioned. But they were partying like, you know, there was no tomorrow. So that's, you know, in those larger cities. Of the families who've lost children, you know, they're being told your sons were heroes. They died defending Russia from Nazis in Ukraine and defending us from the West. Do they all believe it? I don't know. I mean, that's much harder to gauge. But but so far we have not seen a groundswell of opposition to this war. Recently, a number of local deputies, so like on city councils, have signed petition saying Putin has to resign. The petitions don't have the word war in it because you're not allowed to use the word war, but they basically said, you know, what he's doing is very bad for Russia and he should go. But that's just a small number of people. There does not seem to be as yet widespread opposition to the war. And that's because, again, a large number of Russians only receive information from state-run television channels. And that's what they see. It's 24/7, the war against the Nazis in Ukraine. And for those people who do, who have VPNs and who know how to watch different things on different channels, they have a better idea of what's going on. But we don't see widespread opposition yet.
So President Biden is being criticized from Republicans who say he's spending too much money on this war. How long do you believe the U.S. and President Biden can continue with this support of Ukraine by arms, by money, by everything that we're giving them? How can he sustain that support in this country?
Up till now, I think it's been remarkable how much bipartisan support there has been for this war effort and for the money, considering how polarized our society is, and there are very few things on which Democrats and Republicans can agree. But you're quite right that particularly, I would say, from the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party, there's increasing criticism about the amount of money that's being spent on Ukraine. We see that with the upcoming midterms, some of, again, the Trump-endorsed candidates are saying, you know, this isn't our war and Russia should be our friend and we shouldn't be supplying money. So I think if the Republicans, let's say, take the House of Representatives in the midterm elections in November, I think it's going to be more difficult to sustain this. If they were to take both houses, it would be even more difficult to sustain it. And yet there still are Republicans in the Congress that are willing to vote this money in. But it'll become increasingly difficult, particularly, you know, we're suffering from inflation. Gas prices, all right, at the moment, it seems to be somewhat stable now. But when people's, you know, pocketbooks are being hurt by what they perceive as money that's going to Ukraine instead of being spent here, but also by kind of the impact of the sanctions on Russia and how they've impacted us, it will be more difficult. And it's going to be even much more difficult to sustain this in Europe, because there, you know, for those countries that are dependent on Russian energy and Russian gas, it's going to be a very cold winter.
So where do you see this incredible situation? Look in your crystal ball. Where do you see it a year from now?
So again, I would say 2 weeks ago, I probably would have said this war is going to go on certainly for the rest of this year and probably into next year. People were saying until 2024. I'm not so sure about that anymore. I mean, if Ukraine continues to get the U.S. weapons, and as we've just said, that's an if. I mean, it'll be a big if starting in 2023. And if the Ukrainians can keep up this momentum, they certainly, they have a manpower issue too, but of course they've mobilized, you know, they've had a draft right from day one. Then I think you could see if they continue to make gains, it's possible that Russia, that there will be enough questioning inside Russia about should we continue doing this? And I mean now from the part of the generals in Russia and even maybe some of the people around Putin. It's possible there could be some, there could be a negotiation. I mean, I think I don't see that happening now, but it's possible that there could be going forward. Otherwise, what you could have, and you know, if the Ukrainians don't continue to have access to these weapons, then you're, I think you're going to get back more to the war of attrition, with a stalemate, with maybe some ceasefires, and then fighting starting again. And so it, you know, that's in that scenario, it could be a long war. After all, a war has been going on between Ukraine and Russia since 2014, since the conflict in the Donbas began. So that could go on for much longer. So it'll really depend on the Ukrainians' ability to sustain this kind of momentum, and then whether Russia has the ability to regroup and fix some of the problems with their own military.
What do you see a defeat for Putin could mean for not only him, but for Russia?
So I think a defeat for Putin pretty much means that he's going to have to leave office. I mean, he's up for re-election in 2024. And normally you'd say, well, you know, they'll fix the election. He won't have anyone running opposite him. But at that point, the pressure might be on him sufficiently that he really does have to step down. Now, if that's done in a more or less orderly way, probably the person or maybe people who would come to power, some people believe it would be more a collective leadership at the beginning, they would then have to reassess, you know, where Russia goes from there. I mean, Russia will have been then, you know, under sanctions for quite a long time, but, you know, expelled from much of the global economy, demodernized, etc. Are they going to rethink their relationship with their neighbors and with the West, and adjust that? And I think, you know, if you have a more technocratic group of people coming to power or person, like the current prime minister, although I don't necessarily think it would be him, but someone who is basically trained as a technocrat and focuses on the Russian economy might think it might make sense for us to reassess some of that. I don't see rapid change coming. It's very unlikely that Alexei Navalny, now in solitary confinement in prison, is going to be let out and he's suddenly going to take over. But over time, you could get a newer generation of people coming in, again, more technocratic, who might rethink whether it's so important for Russia to try and hang on to essentially its empire, or at least the parts of the Soviet, you know, of the Soviet Union that it lost when the Soviet Union collapsed. I don't see that happening anytime soon. I mean, in Russian history, you have successions were done either when it was the Tsars, you know, death by natural or unnatural causes. People were obviously assassinated too, or palace coups. And then in the Soviet era, it was either death or, in, for instance, Nikita Khrushchev's case or Gorbachev, they were ousted, you know, by their peers. So we really don't have a good, models, predictive models for what can happen. But what we do know is you could have a power struggle if Russia's defeated, if Putin leaves the scene, then you really could have quite an acute power struggle. And that's much harder to see how that would develop.
Angela, thank you so much for such an informative conversation.
Thank you.
That was Angela Stent, non-resident senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and professor emerita at Georgetown University. She's the author of Putin's World, Russia Against the West and With the Rest. And that's all for today. We welcome your feedback and suggestions. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Allison Brody. Our engineer today is Kellen Quigley. Thanks for listening, all. I'll see you next week. I'm Diane Reed.